Today we're going to continue our study of the Greek cultural context of the New Testament period, and we'll be looking today at the Greco-Roman religions and the mystery religions that were in existence and made an impact on the Greek world during the time of Christ and the apostles. As we think about this theme, let's begin our class in prayer and look to the Lord now as we pray to Him. Our Father, You are Israel's King and Redeemer, the Lord Almighty, the first and the last. Apart from You, there is no God. And yet people have always suppressed the truth by their wickedness. The people of the Greek and Roman world, claiming to be wise, became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles. The people of our world, too, substitute idols for the living God. The idols of power and money, fame, sex, and pleasure. And we, too, know the seduction of these idols. Your apostle told the worshipers of the goddess Artemis at Ephesus that man-made gods are no gods at all. Give us the boldness and the conviction to speak against the man-made gods of our age, and give us the allegiance to You that will keep us faithful. May we never turn aside to worthless things. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. As we look at the Greco-Roman paganism of the world of Jesus' time and the time of the apostles, I'd like for us to get into this topic by looking at a passage in the New Testament in Acts chapter 14, Paul's visit to the city of Lystra. This is part of the first missionary journey sent out by the church at Antioch. Remember, Paul and Barnabas went to Cyprus and then traveled from there up to Perga in Pamphylia, where John Mark left them. That was a great disappointment to both of these missionary leaders. They went on then to Antioch in Pisidia and to the area of Lycaonia, modern-day Turkey. And God blessed them, did great things through their ministry. But opposition arose, as you know, because of the Jews who opposed the message that Paul and Barnabas preached and followed them all the way to Lystra. Lystra was a Roman colony, a city of the region of Lycaonia in the province of Galatia. And there, I'd like to read what happened to the missionaries, because it introduces for us the theme of Greco-Roman paganism in the first century world. We'll begin reading in Acts 14, verse 8. In Lystra, there sat a man crippled in his feet, who was lame from birth and had never walked. He listened to Paul as he was speaking. Paul looked directly at him and saw he had faith to be healed, and called out, "Stand up on your feet." At that, the man jumped up and began to walk. When the crowd saw what Paul had done, they shouted in the Lycaonian language, "The gods have come down to us in human form." Barnabas they called Zeus, and Paul they called Hermes, because he was the chief speaker. The priest of Zeus, whose temple was just outside the city, brought bulls and wreaths to the city gates because he and the crowd wanted to offer sacrifices to them. But when the apostles Barnabas and Paul heard of this, they tore their clothes and rushed into the crowd shouting, "Men, why are you doing this? We too are only men, human like you. We are bringing you good news, telling you to turn from these worthless things to the living God who made heaven and earth and sea and everything in them. In the past, He let all nations go their own way, yet He has not left Himself without testimony. He has shown kindness by giving you rain from heaven and crops in their seasons. He provides you with plenty of food and fills your hearts with joy. Even with these words, they had difficulty keeping the crowd from sacrificing to them. Then some Jews came from Antioch and Iconium and won the crowd over. They stoned Paul and dragged him outside the city, thinking he was dead. So from the crowd thinking that Paul was a god, pretty soon they turned against him and ended up stoning him. But as we think about that passage, we have good insight into the Roman world, the Greco-Roman world of the first century. I'd like to use the introduction to a sermon by Cornelius Plantica, professor of systematic theology at Calvin Seminary in Grand Rapids, Michigan, in order to introduce further this passage and to show you something of the benefits of the study of the course New Testament history, not only for general knowledge but for preaching. This is a sermon that appeared in the Reformed Journal in December 1990, entitled "The Gods Have Come Down." In his Metamorphoses, Ovid tells us the story behind this story. For years, people in the district of Lycaonia had loved to tell each other of a time when Zeus and Hermes had visited the town of Lystra, disguised as ordinary travelers in order to test local hospitality. Zeus was, of course, the chief of the gods, and Hermes, a fellow god, was his messenger. But their disguise was so good that nobody in Lystra had recognized them. Dusty and tattered, the two gods had begged for food up and down the streets. But people were not in a holiday mood. "Get lost," people said. "McDonald's is hiring," people added. And doors would slam with a sound like the crack of a pistol. Nobody gave them a crumb. Nobody, that is, except a gentle old couple named Baucis and Philemon, wife and husband. This couple was so kind to their visitors that the two gods granted them their fondest wish, namely that one day they might die together so that neither would be left to mourn. So they died. And Zeus changed them into two tall trees, forever whispering to each other in the wind. Zeus, by the way, so the legend went, was a most dignified and impressive person, but Hermes did all the talking. Now, on a day not in legend but in real life, two strangers came to Lystra. One of them is tall and imposing and silent, the other small but vocal. And at the city gate, a miracle burst out. The strangers heal a lame man who jumps to his feet like some awakened firefighter. The townspeople explode. What could be more wonderful? Zeus and Hermes back again, a return engagement. Everybody wants to meet these gods they have known only by reputation. And no one wants to be anything less than completely reverent. This time, there must be no slip-up. And so, chattering away in their native dialect, the people rush off to fetch the priest of the local temple of Zeus. A couple of sacrificial cows are summoned to their finest hour. Wreaths are hung around their necks, and the people get all dressed up for a church service. For a while, Paul and Barnabas puzzle over all this commotion. They have not read Cochrane's Christianity and Classical Culture, and in any case, the Lycaonian dialect is a wonder to them. Finally, in one startled moment, the apostles catch on. It dawns on them that they're just about to receive the ultimate job promotion. They're not flattered. They rip their clothes and wave their arms and try to call a halt. "No," they say, "hang on here. What are you doing? We are mere mortals just like you. We buckle our sandals one at a time. You can't bow down to the likes of us. No, we bring you good news that you should turn from these worthless things to a living God." So from that New Testament passage and the history behind that passage that Cornelius Plantica brings out in this sermon, we have an introduction to Greco-Roman paganism of the first century A.D. "The gods have come down to us in human form," the people of that city said. As we think about these gods, we go back to Greek antiquity, the gods of Greece, the Greek gods and goddesses go back in history to distant past. The epic age of the gods occurred during the age of Homer, who lived about 800 B.C., and you can read the stories of these gods and goddesses in his great Iliad and Odyssey. The Greek gods are anthropomorphic creatures. They are like humans, only they are bigger than humans and stronger than humans, superior to humans, but in many ways very much like supermen and superwomen. Their conduct is also very much like that of humans. They are not superior in this regard. The story of the Greek gods of Mount Olympus, as you know, are filled with tales of brawling and rape and murder and mutilation and everything else you can imagine. These gods were worshipped by the ancient Greeks. Not that the Greeks were always too sure that this worship was going to do much good, but at least the prevailing view was that the gods and the goddesses could be placated by sacrifices of various kinds, particularly food and wine, which presumably appeal to these gods and goddesses. The main idea, the main religious idea of ancient Greek religion was, I give to you in order that you will take care of me. So the worshippers worshipped by sacrifice and gifts, hoping that the gods would be propitious toward them. But the gods at best were very unpredictable, and one never quite knew what they were going to do next, but nonetheless, worshippers attempted to do their best to stay on the right side of these gods and goddesses. Now that's a sketch of the background of Greek worship. Roman worship was somewhat different. The Greeks had a highly elaborated network of gods and goddesses with rather exciting stories about these figures. Roman deities in the early Roman period were vague spirits, powers of various kinds, but without names and without stories. But as Rome conquered the East, the more picturesque Greek gods and goddesses began to infiltrate Roman religion. They filled up the somewhat emptiness of Roman religion, and even though Rome conquered the East with her legions, the East conquered Rome with its gods. So before long, we can speak of Greco-Roman paganism as the two religions, ancient religions of Greece and Rome, come together. The Roman gods are essentially the same as the Greek gods, as Rome filled its skeleton of religion with Greek content. The names were different. The Greek name for the chief of all gods was Zeus, the major god that is being worshipped at Lystra. The Romans called him Jupiter. It's interesting that if you read the King James Version, you'll get the Roman names for the gods. If you read the NIV, you'll get the Greek name for the god here in Acts 14. Actually, the Greek name is the correct name because that's the name that stands behind the translation. And it should be Zeus rather than Jupiter. But in the King James Version history, in the day of the translation of that Bible, the Roman names were much more common than the Greek names. So Zeus is Jupiter. He's the chief of all the gods. And as Dr. Plantinger suggests in his sermon, the reason Barnabas is identified with Zeus may have been because Barnabas was more imposing in stature. We don't know how Barnabas looked, but presumably there was something about Barnabas, a certain regal bearing, perhaps a tall, handsome man. And so the people immediately said, well, that's Zeus. We do know that Paul was not a striking person in his physical appearance, and they did not see him as Zeus, but they were quite sure that he was Hermes, or Mercury, as the Romans call that god, because Mercury, Hermes, was the messenger of the gods. He was always delivering the messages. And Paul did all the talking here in Lystra. In fact, the text tells us that they called him Hermes because he was the chief speaker of the two. By the New Testament period, ancient pagan religion was declining. Even though we see it here in Lystra, it was not as strong as it had been earlier. Philosophers and poets had exposed the origins of the gods rather than saying the gods were real gods. There were those who said people actually did some great exploits in history. Men and women did various things, and stories circulated about them and became more and more fantastic, and this led to their deification in myth and legend. And philosophers and poets also criticized the immoral conduct of these gods. Trade and travel had increased, as we've already seen in the Roman world. And as people moved around, they began to realize that there are many, many gods, not just their local gods that they had known when they were young. And this welter of deities conflicting against each other and contrasting with each other created confusion and skepticism about the whole concept of the gods of Mount Olympus. There were attempts to revive the ancient Greco-Roman paganism. The poet Virgil, who lived in the first century BC, sought to bolster Roman patriotism by returning to the ancient faith. His argument was, these gods, this religion, has made Rome great, and if we abandon the worship of these gods, then our great empire will be weakened as a result. Virgil wrote the Aeneid, the journey of the heroic Trojan warrior Aeneas from Asia Minor to Italy. And in that story, the Roman gods emerge much improved from their ancient stories, now worthy of respect. Not only do we have the poet Virgil attempting to revive worship of the pagan gods, but the emperor Augustus as well was involved in this process as he set out to strengthen the Roman religion to recover the moral force and patriotism and vitality of early Rome. We already saw that Augustus was made the Pontifex Maximus, the chief priest of the pagan religions, and so he assumed the direction of the state religion, rebuilding the fallen temples and restoring the priestly colleges and so on. Despite the efforts, though, the best efforts of great poets like Virgil and great emperors like Augustus, the twilight of the gods was already at hand by the time we come to the first century. Although the gods are not going to disappear quickly. In fact, it's after the time of Constantine and even up to the time of Augustine that we see periods of revived interest in the gods. When the Roman Empire began to fall apart, many Romans said it's because people have turned to Christianity and have forsaken the ancient gods of our ancestors. That was the occasion for Augustine to write his great City of God in response to that argument. But we're concerned about the first century, and even though the decline had set in, particularly in the provinces, there were still many people who worshiped the gods. The old gods still had a strong hold on the minds of the people out in the provinces. We have examples of that in the New Testament. The temple and the priest of Zeus at Lystra, in the story that we just read earlier, there is archaeological evidence of a joint cult of Zeus and Hermes in the area of Lystra, lasting well into the Christian era. That simply confirms the history that we have here in the book of Acts. Later, Paul goes to the city of Athens, and he discovers that Athens, that sophisticated, cultured center, was full of idols. During his ministry in Ephesus, He comes into conflict with the worshipers of the great goddess Artemis, as she is called in the NIV, using her Greek name. King James uses Diana, the Roman name for this goddess. There was a temple of this goddess at Ephesus. It's one of the striking buildings of the ancient world. It was four times as large as the Parthenon in Athens and was one of the seven wonders of the world. The first temple to the goddess Artemis had burned in 356 B.C. It was burned by a man who said that he did it because he could think of no other way of having his name go down in history. So he burned this building, and he succeeded in perpetuating his name. We know what his name was. It was Herostratus. We know nothing else about him, except he burned the temple. And it was then rebuilt in the magnificent building that stood in Paul's day, housing the image of the goddess Artemis, which was believed by her worshippers to have fallen from heaven. It could have been a meteorite or something like that, but it was taken into the temple, and there in the sacred shrine that image was preserved. The Ephesian Artemis had developed somewhat from the Roman Diana and the earlier Greek goddess of the same name, Artemis. The Ephesian Artemis was a nature goddess of fertility, served by many prostitute priestesses. And then we have a further glimpse into the paganism of the New Testament period when we read about the story of the people of Malta who first view Paul, who has been shipwrecked there, bitten by the viper, as a robber because now he is receiving his just reward for his crimes. But when Paul was not affected by the bite of this poisonous snake, they suddenly changed their minds and decided that he was a god. The reverse of what happened at Lystra. So as we glance through the book of Acts, particularly, we see that in the first century, the worship of pagan deities was very much present in the Roman world, where Paul and the early missionaries worked. Let's think for a moment about the Jewish attitude to the pagan religions and then the Christian attitude toward these pagan religions. The Old Testament is full of passages, particularly the book of Isaiah, passages of polemic against idolatry. Isaiah 44, verses 9 through 20, is perhaps the classic exposure of idolatry in the Old Testament. You may remember that passage. Man makes an idol, gets a piece of wood, makes an idol, does it very carefully with a great deal of concern for it, and finally he's finished. And then he gets down in front of it and prays to it. "Deliver me," he says, "for you are my God." And Isaiah, in telling that story, which is how idols were made, ridicules it. Idolatry had been a problem, as we know from Old Testament study, in the pre-exilic history of Israel. People were constantly tempted to go after other gods and worship Baal and Ashtaroth. But the exile appears to have been a purifying process, because as the people returned from Babylon, they're not tempted now by the idols as they had been tempted earlier. In fact, as we look at Hellenistic Jewish literature, we see some books written very much to attack the worship of idols. The letter of Aristeus and the Book of Wisdom, not suggesting that the Jews were tempted by this idolatry, but simply stating, as Isaiah had done, the folly of idolatry. So the Greco-Roman religion was not a big problem to the Jews. They recognized the stories, they heard the stories, but this was not their religion, and it did not greatly influence them. What about the Christian attitude to the pagan religions? Well, obviously, the Christians are not going to be tempted either in this direction. Paul and Barnabas at Lystra give us a case study here. They attempt to stop the worship of themselves as gods. They are horrified at the thought. And then they use the occasion to show the folly of idolatry and to lead the people of Lystra to a knowledge of the true God. Paul's speech on that occasion is an example of how Paul approached unsophisticated pagans. Now, next time we'll see how Paul approached sophisticated pagans in his speech at the Areopagus in Athens. But in Lystra, Paul is dealing with people who are not philosophers, but simple worshipers of the ancient deities. Paul stresses God's natural revelation as creator and sustainer of the universe. In other words, he focuses on common grace. In the synagogues, he'll quote the Old Testament, but there was no point in quoting the Old Testament to the Lystrans. They did not know it. He, however, focused on the teaching of God as creator and sustainer, told people that they should give up worship of these worthless things and turn to the living God. Paul's great indictment of paganism is found in Romans 1, 18 through 32. But at Lystra, he does the same thing. He actually presents, I think, the first stage of the gospel to pagans. In the next stage, if he had had the opportunity, which he did not have at Lystra, he would have told them how this creator, sustainer God also made provision for their redemption by sending his son from heaven. Now, I've said earlier that Greco-Roman paganism, despite its appearance in the New Testament, was in a period of decline, was failing. And in the void that was created by the loss of faith in these old gods, there was a new type of pagan religion that began to move in to fill that religious emptiness. It did not really succeed in filling the emptiness. The emptiness would stay there, despite all the religions of the first century, to be filled only by Christ and the gospel of the Lord. But in the decline, I won't say collapse, because that comes later, in the decline of Greco-Roman religions in the first century, new religions called mystery religions began to affect the Roman world. These were religions such as the Eleusinian mysteries from Greece, or the religion of Magna Mater, the great mother, and Attis from Phrygia in Asia, or Osiris and Isis from Egypt, and many other religions as well. It's rather hard to categorize these religions because they're quite different from one another, but we call them mystery religions, and I can tell you some of the common features that they had. Each of these religions had a story. Generally, there were two gods, a god and a goddess, a female goddess and either her son or her lover, sometime the same. And the story was not only about these two deities, but it usually involved the story of the death of one of the deities and what the other one did in order to bring about a resurrection. So each of the mysteries had a dramatic story focusing on a death and resurrection theme. Generally, the death and resurrection theme grew out of an earlier nature religion. So the death and resurrection theme was an explanation for the change of the seasons. The season dies in the fall and winter and then is revived in the spring. That cycle of seasons is explained by the story. Sometimes the story relates to the cycle of day and night, but it attempts to explain some of these natural phenomena. So there's a story. There is in the mysteries an elaborate initiation. These initiations were secret. That's why they're called mystery religions. Only the person who was being brought into the religion would know the full meaning and know the steps of the initiation. But it was an elaborate ritual. In at least one of the mysteries, it meant, in part, crouching in a pit while a bull was sacrificed above, and then the blood would drip down over the person being brought into the religion. The person would bathe in the blood and drink some of it. This was part of the process of being initiated into that particular religion. And then the initiation into the mystery religion resulted in some personal benefits to the worshiper. There was a kind of emotional satisfaction in the mysteries that did not occur in the worship of the ancient gods and goddesses. A kind of sense of belonging. And the elaborate initiation and ritual satisfied the desire for ceremony in the minds and hearts of the people. Beyond that, the initiate in the mystery religion was promised certain earthly blessings, generally prosperity, fertility, and various things that people sought. And that even beyond that, the mysteries held out some kind of hope beyond the grave. As the worshiper was initiated into the mystery, he or she then identified with the deity, and through that identification with the deity, there were not only promises of the temporal blessings of earth, but everlasting life. Now, some people have thought that sounds awfully much like Christianity, and even some have argued that Christianity is based somewhat on the mysteries. I think that's totally wrong, and I'll refer to a book later that you can read that explodes that idea, but it is an idea that you'll read in popular books and also hear from university professors who lecture on religious matters, that Christianity is just one of the mysteries, and you can see the parallels, the death and resurrection of the God, the initiation through baptism, and the promised benefits in this life and the world to come. The initiation into the mysteries was quite expensive. And even though the mysteries appeal to people, few could afford the price of immortality. The Roman world needed another religion, a living hope, freely offered to all those who were thirsty for everlasting life. The mystery religions moved out of the East into the West, became popular in the West, even in Rome, despite some attempts to prevent their spread to Rome. One Roman writer, Tacitus, said everything polluted ends up finally in Rome, and the mystery religions came there too. The mysteries, however, had very little effect upon the Jews. We're concerned about New Testament history and the context, the Greek context, Greco-Roman context of the first century, but at this point there is not much parallel that can be made between the religions, either the pagan religions or the mystery religions, and they're all the same. The mysteries are simply a form of Greco-Roman paganism. These religions did not influence the Jews. And neither did the Christian faith, I think, experience an impact from the Greek mysteries. There's no evidence of Christian indebtedness to the mystery religions, despite the claims of some scholars to the contrary. Christianity does have, of course, a dying God, but the God of the New Testament, the Lord who dies, is not like the mystery religion gods. They don't have a God who came to earth and died voluntarily to save human beings from sin. There's nothing like that in the mystery religions. They arise from a kind of nature religion, as I said a moment ago. There is, too, a rising God in Christianity, but the dying and rising gods of the mysteries were tied to the cycle of nature, this happen over and over again. This is the story that is repeatable as the seasons repeat themselves. But Christ's resurrection is a one-time historical event, neither a repeated feature of nature nor a myth of the past. The initiation into the mystery religions supposedly brought deliverance from fate and the terrors of the afterlife, but there is no concept in the mysteries of redemption from sin. This is simply not a problem, not a point that is part of the mystery religions. And as I said also a moment ago, the mystery religions, the initiation was expensive. It was not for everyone. The rites were secret, and this contrasts very much with the Christian religion. The book that I mention is the book by Ronald Nash called Christianity and the Hellenistic World. Part 2 deals with the mystery religions, and will fill out in large detail the comments that I have just made in a brief form. So today we've been looking at the Greek world, the religious aspect of the Greek world, and we've seen that paganism, worship of the old gods, was still alive, in decline, but still alive, particularly in places like Lystra and in Ephesus and Malta, out in the provinces. And Christianity had to come to find ways to oppose it, preach against it, as Paul does at Lystra. The mystery religions were very popular, perhaps in their heyday, but they did not influence the Jews, who stayed clear from idolatry of this kind, and the mysteries are not the source for the Christian faith. Christianity is a totally different religion from that of the mysteries. There was another form of religion that we're going to look at next time that attempted to fill something of the void left by the slow decline of the Greco-Roman pagan gods. This was Greek philosophy, which appealed particularly to the educated peoples. By the time we come to the first century, Greek philosophy is not simply the metaphysical systems of the past, pure philosophy, but first system Greek philosophies such as Stoicism and Epicureanism had developed into forms of religion, ways of life, attempting to bring hope to people who would follow them. We'll look at that next time.